Bookshelf is a production of Spokane Public Radio. I'm Cheryl Ann Millsap, and I'm reading from Tenting Tonight by Mary Roberts Rinehart. In the words of the introduction to Tenting Tonight, Mary Roberts Rinehart, in her two trips to Glacier National Park during the early years of the 20th century, well before the park was a popular destination, offers clear evidence of her venturesome spirit. Rinehart documented these two adventures, led by dude rancher Howard Eaton of Wolf, Wyoming, in the pair of delightful travelogues, Through Glacier Park, 1916, and Tenting Tonight, 1918. Tonight, continuing Chapter 9, The Roundup at Kalispell. Kalispell is a flourishing and attractive town of northwestern Montana. It is notable for many other things besides its annual roundup, but it remains dear to me for one particular reason. My hat was done. It had no longer the spring and elasticity of youth. It was scarred with many rains and many fish hooks. It had ceased to add its necessary jaunty touch to my costume. It detracted. In its age, I loved it, but the family insisted cruelly on a change. So, sitting on Angel, a new one was brought for me, a chirky young thing, a cowgirl affair of high felt crown and broad brim. And at this moment, a gentleman I had never seen before, but who is green in my memory, stepped forward and presented me with his own hatband. It was of leather, and it bore the vigorous and inspiriting inscription, "Give her pep and let her buck." Today, when I am low in my mind, I take that cowgirl hat from its retreat and read its inscription, "Give her pep and let her buck." It is a whole creed. Somewhere, among my papers, I have the program of that roundup at Kalispell. It was a very fine roundup. There was a herd of buffalo. There were wild horses and long-horned Mexican steers. There was a cheering crowd. There was roping and marvelous riding. But my eyes were fixed on the grandstand with a stony stare. I am an adopted Blackfoot Indian, known in the tribe as Pi-ta-mac-an, and only a few weeks before I had had a long conference with the chiefs of the tribe, Two Guns, White Calf, the son of Old White Calf, the great chief who dropped dead in the White House during President Cleveland's administration, Medicine Owl, Curly Bear, and Big Spring, and Bird Plume, and Wolf Plume, and Bird Rattler, and Bill Shoot, and Stabs by Mistake, and Eagle Child, and many tail feathers, and many more. And these Indians had all promised me that as soon as our conference was over, they were going back to the reservation to get in their hay and work hard for the great herd which the government had promised to give them. They were going to be good Indians. So I stared at the grandstand with a cold and fixed eye. For there, many miles from where they should have been, off the reservation without permission of the Indian agent, painted and bedecked in all the glory of their forefathers, paint, feathers, beads, strings of thimbles, and little mirrors, handsome, bland, and enjoying every instant to the full in their childish hearts, were my chiefs. During the first lull in the proceedings, a delegation came to visit me and to explain. This is what they said. First of all, they desired me to make peace with the Indian agent. He was, they considered, most unreasonable. There were many times when one could labor, and there was but one roundup. They petitioned then that I intercede and see that their ration tickets were not taken away. And even as the interpreter told me their plea, one old brave caught my hand and pointed across to the enclosure, where a few captive buffalo were grazing. I knew what it meant. These, my Blackfeet, had been the great buffalo hunters. With bow and arrow they had followed the herds from Canada to the far south. These chiefs had been mighty hunters, but for many years not a single buffalo had their eyes beheld. They who had lived by the buffalo were now dying with them. A few full bloods shut away on a reservation, a few buffalo penned in a corral. Children of the open spaces and of freedom, both of them, and now dying and imprisoned, for the Blackfeet are a dying people. they had come to see the buffalo. But they did not say so. An Indian is a stoic. He has both imagination and sentiment, but the latter he conceals. And this was the explanation they gave me for the Indian agent. I knew that, back in my home, when a friend asked me to come to an entertainment, I must go or that friend would be offended with me. And so it was with the Blackfeet Indians. They had been invited to this roundup, and they felt they should come or they would hurt the feelings of those who had asked them. Therefore would I go to the Indian agent and make their peace for them. For after all, summer was short and winter was coming. The old would need their ration tickets again, and they, the braves, would promise to go back to the reservation and get in the hay and be all that good Indians should be. And I, too, was as good an Indian as I knew how to be, for I scolded them all roundly and then sat down at the first possible opportunity and wrote to the agent. And the agent? He is a very wise and kindly man, facing one of the biggest problems in our country. He gave them back their ration tickets and wiped the slate clean, to the eternal credit of a government that has not often to the Indian tempered justice with mercy. Chapter 10. Off for Cascade Pass. How many secrets the mountains hold! They have forgotten things we shall never know, and they are cruel, savagely cruel. What they want, they take. They reach out 1,000 clutching hands. They attack with avalanche, starvation, loneliness, precipice. They lure on with green valleys and high flowering meadows where mountain sheep move sedately, with sunlit peaks and hidden lakes, with silence for tired ears and peace for weary souls. And then they kill. Because man is a fighting animal, he obeys their call, his wit against their wisdom of the ages, his strength against their solidity, his courage against their cunning, and too often he loses. I'm afraid of the mountains. I always have the feeling that they are lying in wait. At night, their very silence is ominous. The crack of ice as a bit of slow-moving glacier is dislodged. Lightning and the roar of thunder somewhere below where I lie. These are the artillery of the range, and from them I am safe. I am too small for their heavy guns. But a shelving trail on the verge of a chasm, a slip on an ice field, a rolling stone under a horse's foot, these are the weapons I fear above the timberline. Even below there is danger, swamps and rushing rivers, but above all the forest. In mountain valleys it grows thick on the bodies of dead forest beneath. It crowds, there's barely room for a tent, and all through the night the trees protest. They creak and groan and sigh. Sometimes they burn. In a cul-de-sac with only frowning cliffs about, the forest becomes ominous, a thing of dreadful beauty. On nights when, through the crevices of the green roof, there are stars hung in the sky, the weight lifts. But there are other nights when the trees close in like ranks of hostile men and take the spirit prisoner. The peace of the wilderness is not peace. It is waiting. On the Glacier Park trip, there had been one subject which came up for discussion night after night around the campfire. It resolved itself briefly into this. Should we or should we not get out in time to go over to the state of Washington and there perform the thrilling feat which Bob the Optimist had in mind? This was nothing more or less than the organization of a second pack outfit and the crossing of the Cascade Mountains on horseback by a virgin route. The head, Bob and Joe, had many discussions about it. I do not recall that my advice was ever asked. It is generally taken for granted in these wilderness trips of ours that I will be there, ready to get a story when the opportunity presents itself. Owing to the speed with which the North Fork of the Flathead River descends from the Canadian border to civilization, we had made very good time, and at last the decision was made to try this new adventure. "It will be a bully story," said the Optimist. "And you can be dead sure of this. It's never been done before." So at last it was determined, and we set out on that wonderful harebrained excursion of which the very memory gives me a thrill. Yet, now that I know it can be done, I may try it again some day. It paid for itself over and over in scenery and health and in thrills. But there were several times when it seemed to me impossible that we could all get over the range alive. We took through 31 horses and 19 people. When we got out, our horses had had nothing to eat, not a blade of grass or a handful of grain, for 36 hours, and they had had very little for 5 days. On the last morning, the head gave his horse for breakfast one rain-soaked biscuit, an apple, 2 lumps of sugar, and a raw egg. The other horses had nothing. We dropped 3 pack horses over cliffs in 2 days, but got them again, cut and bruised, and we took out our outfit complete after 2 weeks of the most arduous going I've ever known anything about. When the news that we had got over the pass penetrated to the settlements, a pack outfit started over Cascade Pass in our footsteps to take supplies to a miner. They killed 3 horses on that same trail, and I believe gave it up in the end. Doubtless, by next year, a passable trail will have been built up to Doubtful Lake, and another one up to that 800-foot mountain wall above the lake, where, when one reaches the top, there is but room to look down again on the other side. Perhaps, too, there will be a trail down the Agnes Creek Valley so that parties can get through easily. When that is done, and it is promised by the forest supervisor, one of the most magnificent horseback trips in the country will be opened for the first time to the traveler. Most emphatically, the trip across the Cascades at Doubtful Lake and Cascade Pass is not a trip for a woman in the present condition of things, although any woman who can ride can cross Cloudy Pass and get down Agnes Creek Way. But perhaps before this is published, the Chelan National Forest will have been made a national park. It ought to be. It is superb. There is no other word for it. And it ought not to be called a forest, because it seems to have everything but trees, rocks and rivers and glaciers, more in one country than all of Switzerland, they claim, and granite peaks and hair-raising precipices and lakes filled with ice in midsummer, but not many trees, until at Cascade Pass one reaches the boundaries of the Washington National Forest and begins to descend the Pacific Slope. The personnel of our party was slightly changed. Of the original one, there remained the head, the big, the middle, and the little boy, Joe, Bob, and myself. To these we added at the beginning 6 persons besides our guides and packers. 2 of them did not cross the pass, however. The forest pathologist from Washington, who travels all over the country watching for tree diseases and tree epidemics, and who left us after a few days. And the supervisor of Chelan Forest, who had but just come from Oregon and was making his first trip over his new territory. We were fortunate indeed in having 4 forest men with us, men whose lives are spent in the big timber, who know the every mood and tense of the wilderness. For besides these 2, the pathologist and the forest supervisor, there was Silent Laurie Lindsley, a naturalist, photographer, and lover of all that is wild, a young man who has spent years wandering through the mountains around Chelan, camera and gun at hand, the gun never raised against the wild creatures, but used to shoot away tree branches that interfere with pictures, or more frequently, to trim a tree into such outlines as fit into the photograph. And then there was the man who went ahead. For 40 years this man, Mr. Hilligross, has lived in the forest. Hardly a big timber deal in the northwest but was passed by him. Hardly a tree in that vast wilderness but that he knew it. He knew everything about the forest but fear and fatigue. And with an axe and a gun, he went ahead clearing trail, blazing trees, and marking the detours to campsites by an arrow made of bark and thrust through a slash in a tree. Hour after hour we would struggle on, seeing everywhere evidences of his skill on the trail, to find, just as endurance had reached its limit, the arrow that meant camp and rest. And there was Dan DeVore and his dog, Whiskers. Dan DeVore was our chief guide and outfitter, a soft-voiced, bearded, big-souled man, neither very large nor very young. All soul and courage was Dan DeVore, and one of the proudest moments of my life was when it was all over and he told me I had done well. I wanted most awfully to have Dan DeVore think I had done well. He was sitting on a stone at the time, I remember, and Whiskers, his old Airedale, had his head on Dan's knee. All of his 13 years, Whiskers had wandered through the mountains with Dan DeVore, always within call. To see Dan was to see Whiskers. To see Whiskers was to see Dan. He slept on Dan's tarp bed at night, and in the daytime led our long and winding procession. Indomitable spirit that he was, he traveled 3 miles to our one, saved us from the furious onslaughts of many a marmot and mountain squirrel, and in the absence of fresh meat ate his salt pork and scraps with zest. Then there were Mr. and Mrs. Fred. I call them Mr. and Mrs. Fred because, like Joe, that was a part of their name. I will be frank about Mrs. Fred. I was worried about her before I knew her. I was accustomed to roughing it, but how about another woman? Would she be putting her hair in curlers every night and whimpering when, as sometimes happens, the slow gait of her horse became intolerable? Little did I know Mrs. Fred. She was a natural wanderer, a follower of the trail, a fine and sound and sporting traveling companion, and I like to think she is typical of the women of that western country which bred her, feminine to the core, but strong and sweet still. Both the Freds were great additions. Was it not after Mr. Fred that we trailed on that famous game hunt of ours, of which a spirited account is coming later? Was it not Mr. Fred who night after night took the junior Reinhardts away from an anxious mother into the depths of the forest or the bleakness of mountain slopes, there to lie, armed to the teeth, and wait for the first bears to start out for breakfast? Now you have us, I think, except the men of the outfit, and they deserve space I cannot give them. They were a splendid lot, and it was by their incessant labor that we got over. Try to see us, then, filing along through deep valleys, climbing cliffs, stumbling, struggling, not talking much, a long line of horses and riders. First, far ahead, Mr. Hillegas, then the riders led by Silent Laurie, with me just behind them because of photographs. Then at the head of the pack horses, Dan DeVore. Then the long line of pack ponies, sturdy and willing and piled high with our food, our bedding, and our tents. And here and there and everywhere, Joe with the moving picture camera. We were determined this time to have no repetition of the Glacier Park fiasco, where Bill, our cook, had deserted us at a bad time, although it is always a bad time when the cook deserts. So now we had two cooks. Much as I love the mountains and the woods, the purple of evening valleys, the faint pink of sunrise on snow-covered peaks, the most really thrilling sight of a camping trip is two cooks bending over an iron grating above a fire, one frying trout and the other turning flapjacks. Our trail led us through one of the few remaining unknown portions of the United States. It cannot remain long unknown. It is too superb, too wonderful. And it has mineral in it, silver and copper and probably coal. The middle boy, who is by way of being a chemist and has systematically blown himself up with homemade explosives for years, the middle boy found at least a dozen silver mines of fabulous value, although the men in the party insisted that his specimens were iron pyrites and other unromantic minerals. I'm Cheryl Ann Millsap, and I'm reading from Tenting Tonight by Mary Roberts Reinhardt. Chapter 11, Lake Chelan to Lyman Lake. Now, as to where we were. Those long days of fording rivers and beating our way through jungle or of dizzy climbs up to the snow, those short nights, so cold that 6 blankets hardly kept us warm, while our tired horses wandered far, searching for such bits of grass as grew among the shale. In the north-central part of the state of Washington, nature has done a curious thing. She has built a great lake in the eastern shoulders of the Cascade Mountains. Lake Chelan, more than 50 miles long and averaging 1.5 miles in width, is 1,075 feet above sea level, while its bottom is 400 feet below the level of the ocean. It is almost completely surrounded by granite walls and peaks which reach more than 1.5 miles into the air. The region back from the lake is practically unknown. A small part of it has never been touched by the Geological Survey, and in 1 or 2 instances we were able to check up errors on our map. Thus, a lake shown on our map as belonging at the head of McAllister Creek really belongs at the head of Rainbow Creek, while McAllister Lake is not shown at all. Mr. Coulter, a forester who was with us for a time, last year discovered 3 lakes at the head of Rainbow Creek which have never been mapped and, so far as could be learned, had never been seen by a white man before. Yet Lake Chelan itself is well known in the Northwest. It is easily reached, its gateway being the famous Wenatchee Valley, celebrated for its apples. It was from Chelan that we were to make our start. Long before we arrived, Dan DeVore and the packers were getting the outfit ready. Yet the first glimpse of Chelan was not attractive. We had motored half a day through that curious, semi-arid country which, when irrigated, proves the greatest of all soils in the world for fruit raising. The August sun had baked the soil into yellow dust, which covered everything. Arid hillsides, without a leaf of green but dotted thickly with gray sagebrush, eroded valley, rocks and gullies, all shone a dusty yellow in the heat. The dust penetrated everything. Wherever water could be utilized were orchards, little trees planted in geometrical rows and only waiting the touch of irrigation to make their owners wealthy beyond dreams. The lower end of Lake Chelan was surrounded by these bleak hillsides, desert without the great spaces of the desert. Yet unquestionably, in a few years from now, these bleak hillsides will be orchard land. Only the lower part, however, is bleak. Only an end, indeed. There is nothing more beautiful and impressive than the upper part of that strangely deep and quiet lake lying at the foot of its enormous cliffs. By devious stages we reached the head of Lake Chelan, and there for 4 days the outfitting went on. Horses were being brought in, saddles fitted, provisions in great cases were arriving. To outfit a party of our size for 2 weeks means labor and generous outlay, and we were going to be comfortable. We were willing to travel hard and sleep hard, but we meant to have plenty of food. I think we may claim the unique distinction of being the only people who ever had grapefruit regularly for breakfast at the top of that portion of the Cascade Range. While we waited, we learned something about the country. It is volcanic ash, disintegrated basalt, this grapefruit country, to the right of the range, and three things apparently are responsible for its marvelous fruit-growing properties. First, the soil itself, which needs only water to prove marvelously fertile. Second, the length of the growing season, which around Lake Chelan is 192 days in the year, and this just south of the Canadian border. There is a third reason, too. The valleys are sheltered from frost. Even if a frost comes, and I believe it is almost unknown, the high mountains surrounding these valleys protect the blossoms so that the frost has evaporated before the sun strikes the trees. There is no such thing known as a killing frost. But it is irrigation on a virgin and fertile soil that is primarily responsible. They run the water to the orchards and conduits, and then dig little trenches running parallel among the trees. Then they turn it on, and the tree roots are bathed, soaked. And out of the desert spring such trees of laden fruit that each branch must be supported by wires. So we ate such apples as I have never dreamed of, and waited. Joe got his films together. The boys practiced shooting. I rested and sharpened lead pencils. Bob had found a way to fold his soft hat into what he fondly called the Jennings Dew, which meant a plait in the crown to shed the rain, and which turned an amiable ensemble into something savage and extremely flat on top. The head played croquet. And then, into our complacency came, one night, a bit of tragedy. A man staggered into the little hotel at the head of the lake, carrying another man on his back. He had carried him for 40 hours, lowering him down bit by bit from that mountain highland where he had been hurt. 40 hours of superhuman effort and heartbreaking going over cliffs and through wilderness. The injured man was a sheep herder. He had cut his leg with the wood axe, and blood poisoning had set in. I do not know the rest of that story. The sheep herder was taken to a hospital the next day, traveling a very long way. But whether he traveled still farther, to the land of the Great Shepherd, I do not know. Only this I do know, that this western country I love is full of such stories, and of such men as the hero of this one. At last we were ready. Some of the horses were sent by boat the day before, for this strange lake has little or no shoreline. Granite mountaintop slopes dark and sheer to the water's edge, and drop from there to frightful depths below. There are, at the upper end, no roads, no trails or paths that border it. So the horses and all of us went by boat to the mouth of Railroad Creek, so-called, I suppose, because the nearest railroad is more than 40 miles away, up which led the trail to the great unknown. All around and above us there were cliffs, towering 7,000 feet over the lake, and beyond those cliffs lay adventure. For it was adventure. Even Dan DeVore, experienced mountaineer and guide that he was, had only been to Cascade Pass once, and that was 16 years before. He had never been across the divide. Silent Laurie Lindsley, the naturalist, had only been partway down the Agnes Creek Valley, which we intended to follow. Only in a general way had we any itinerary at all. Now, a national forest is a happy hunting ground, whereas in the national parks game is faithfully preserved, hunting is permitted in the forest. To this end, we took with us a complete arsenal. The naturalist carried a Colt's revolver. The big boy had a 12-gauge hammerless called a howitzer. We had two 24-gauge shotguns in case we met an elephant or anything similarly large and heavy, and the little boy proudly carried, strapped to his saddle, a 22 high-power rifle, shooting a steel-jacketed, soft-nosed bullet, an express rifle of high velocity and great alarm to mothers. In addition to this, we had a Savage repeater and two Winchester 30s, and the forest supervisor carried his own Winchester 38. We were entirely prepared to meet the whole German army. It is sad, rather, to relate that with all this preparation we killed nothing whatsoever. Although it is not true that on the day we encountered a large bear and the three junior members of the family were allowed to turn the artillery loose on him, at the end of the firing the bear pulled out a flag and waved it, thinking it was the 4th of July. As we started that August midday for the long, dusty ride up Railroad Creek, I am sure that the three junior Reinhardts had nothing less in mind than two or three bear skins apiece for school bedrooms. They deserved better luck than they had. Night after night, sitting in the comparative safety of the campfire, I have seen my three sons, the big, the middle, and the little boy, starting off, armed to the teeth with deadly weapons, to sleep out under the stars and catch the first unwary bear on his way to breakfast in the morning. Morning after morning I have sat breakfastless and shaken until the weary procession of young America toiled into camp, hungry and bearless, but, thank heaven, whole of skin, save where mosquitoes and black flies had taken their toll of them. They would trudge 5 miles, sleep 3 hours, hunt, walk 5 miles back, and then ride all day. I'm Cheryl Ann Millsap. I've been reading from Tenting Tonight by Mary Roberts Reinhardt, which was republished in 2002 by Riverbend Publishing, Helena, Montana, in cooperation with the Montana Historical Society. Bookshelf is a feature of Spokane Public Radio. Vern Windham and Nancy Roth, executive producers, producer Caitlin Maroney.